All right, well, thanks for coming today. I want to introduce the two speakers, and then we'll get right into the action, okay? Mr. Jeff Schaefer serves as senior legal counsel in the Washington, D.C. office of the Alliance Defense Fund. A 1995 graduate of the Regent University School of Law, he has litigated religious liberty and free speech cases in federal and state trial and appellate courts throughout the United States. Before joining the Alliance Defense Fund in Washington, D.C., he practiced in Cincinnati, Ohio, and after a number of years of practice dedicated predominantly to criminal defense work, he co-founded the partnership of Langdon & Schaefer, LLC, emphasizing public interest constitutional litigation. Dr. Jeremy Gunn, came to the ACLU, he works at the ACLU in D.C., from Emory Law School in Atlanta, where he served for 5 years as a Senior Fellow for Religion and Human Rights and a Senior Associate at the Institute for Global Engagement. Dr. Gunn received his Ph.D. in Religion and Society from Harvard University in 1991 and his J.D. from Boston University. He earned an M.A. In Humanities at the University of Chicago and his B.A. in International Relations and Humanities at Brigham Young University. Let's welcome our debaters. At this time, Mr. Schaefer is going to come and he's going to speak in the affirmation of the following resolution. Resolved, the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Establishment Clause, requiring the government to act with a secular legislative purpose and prohibiting government from conveying a message that endorses religion, is faulty. A secularity requirement is conceptually problematic, not required by the text of the First Amendment, and incompatible with our nation's history and traditions.
Thank you to the Federalist Society for the invitation, and a good afternoon to all of you. Professor Roberto Unger, in his book, Law in Modern Society, presented the following provocative question. What happens when the positive rules of the state lose all touch with a higher law and come to be seen as nothing more than the outcomes of a power struggle? Can the ideals in law survive the demise of the religious beliefs that presided over their birth? Now, Unger's questions, I think, are relevant to the subject of discussion this afternoon in that our constitutionalism and our liberty commitments that, as a historical matter, were solidly premised upon religious principles, are now being used to exclude from legislative participation in government expression the very religious worldview that gave them birth. The secularizing of government action and expression in the name of religious freedom is a marked irony in view of its own religious pedigree. Now, there's near consensus that the Supreme Court's case law on the Establishment Clause realm is incoherent. My own opinion for that condition and why it exists is that the court fundamentally errs in its basic categories of analysis as it impugns our best political traditions. The position which I aim to criticize is that which asserts that the government may not endorse theistic or religious beliefs or legislate from a religious purpose. Recent decades have seen increased emphasis on the not well-defined idea of secularity as an obligation carried by governments. One thinks of the endorsement test bequeathed by Justice O'Connor that forbids the government to communicate or to act in a way that communicates that the government believes a particular religious view to be meritorious. The interpretation of the Establishment Clause that I think is most consistent with its text and with its historical context is that it is preeminently a federalism mechanism that left issues of religion to the various states, many of which at the time had religious establishments of their own and had various approaches to issues of religious freedom. At the federal level, however, the First Amendment's objective was to create an institutional separation. The ecclesiastical and civil jurisdictions were to remain separate. However, what is not required by the Establishment Clause is a separation between government and religious precept or principle. First of all, the text of the First Amendment imposes no restrictions on the kinds of beliefs that may motivate and justify legislation or may be conveyed in government speech. Establishment at the time of the founding era was understood as relating to an institution or a monopoly status such as existed in the church-crown arrangement in the Anglican Church in Britain. And some of the government-supported churches in the colonies as well. The goal of the Establishment Clause, though, was not an impossible psychological divestiture that aimed to rid government actors of the Christian and theistic worldview that was prominent at the time. Which leads to my next point, which is that the climate of opinion during the founding era was such that the secularism proposal would have struck that generation as utterly implausible. About 45 years after the Constitution's ratification, Alexis de Tocqueville wrote in his Democracy in America, "There is no country in the world where the Christian religion retains a greater influence over the souls of men than in America. Religion," he wrote, "is the first of their political principles." The 19th century Supreme Court justice and legal scholar Joseph Story wrote in his commentary on the Constitution the following: "Probably at the time of the adoption of the Constitution and of the First Amendment, the general, if not the universal, sentiment in America was that Christianity ought to receive encouragement from the state so far as was not incompatible with the private rights of conscience and the freedom of religious worship. In any attempt to level all religions and to make it a matter of state policy to hold all in utter indifference would have created universal disapprobation, if not universal indignation." Now, the social milieu at the time of the founding was one emphatically steeped in theological discourse, reflective of essentially the universal belief structure at the time. And this can be shown by any number of anecdotal observations. I could draw from some for quite some time. I'll just go with the usual suspects this afternoon. But the general idea is there existed no viable notion that political life could be separated from religious precept. Washington, in his farewell address, for instance, did not hesitate to admonish that of all the dispositions and habits that lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. And as president, Washington, in his Thanksgiving proclamation in 1799, declared that it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor. And he called the nation to the service of, quote, "that great and glorious being who is the beneficent author of all the good that was, that is, and that will be." He included in that list of goods, not so incidentally, the civil and religious liberty with which we are blessed. Washington's successor, John Adams, in 1798, likewise issued such a national call to prayer that he initiated as follows: "As the safety and prosperity of nations ultimately and essentially depend on the protection and the blessing of Almighty God, and the national acknowledgement of this truth is not only an indispensable duty which the people owe to Him, but a duty whose natural influence is favorable to the promotion of that morality and piety without which social happiness cannot exist, nor the blessings of free government be enjoyed." This was not just the form of public speaking at the time either. Remember, the legal structures at the time were similar. The common law rule adopted by the colonies and extended into the states, carried on there, disqualified a witness from testifying in court unless he affirmed a belief in God and a personal accountability for sin. In the founding era, all colonies, barring Rhode Island, required, before one could serve in government office, a profession of Christian faith. You should read the oaths of office found in the early state constitutions to get a sense of how the states identified Christianity to be indispensable not only to the health of society, but to civil institutions as well. The Declaration of Independence, remember, states that our Creator is the source of our unalienable rights that governments are obliged to acknowledge, thus offering a theological basis both for individual rights and for government responsibility. The treaty that resolved the conflict with Great Britain in 1783 commenced in the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity. Are you seeing a pattern? Drawing now a little closer to our First Amendment subject, the two principal works that the Supreme Court has identified, rightly or wrongly, as illuminating the meaning of Establishment Clause, or the religion clauses of the First Amendment, are Jefferson's Bill for Religious Freedom in Virginia and Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance Against Religious Assessment. Relevant for our purposes is the fact that both of these documents vindicate the religious freedom positions by theological arguments. definition of religion used by Madison in his Remonstrance is dependent on a belief in the Creator, and that there are duties owed to him alone outside of civil cognizance. This is the foundation for his argument in that paper. He uses theological considerations throughout. He writes of obligations to God. He references the means of salvation. The proposed legislation he was challenging therein perverts those means. And he argues that the law he was opposing is a contradiction to the Christian religion itself. He further speaks of the light of Christianity, which he calls a precious gift, and which he contrasts with false religion. Madison concludes the Remonstrance with a prayer petitioning divine intervention in the affairs of the General Assembly. And as for Jefferson's bill for establishing religious freedom in Virginia, its preamble presents a theological argument for the contents of the statute. It reads, "Whereas Almighty God has created the mind free, that all attempts to influence it by temporal punishments or burdens, or by civil incapacitations, tend only to beget habits of hypocrisy and meanness, and are a departure from the plan of the holy author of our religion, who, being Lord of both body and mind, yet chose not to propagate it by coercions on either, as was in his almighty power to do." What is eminently clear from these works of Madison and Jefferson is that the concept of religious freedom, for which they were such ardent proponents, does not have appended to it the notion that theological considerations may not inform policy decisions or public expressions of the government. Quite to the contrary, Jefferson and Madison themselves argued for their religious freedom positions using theological concepts. Now, if there was a particular theological worldview that gave rise to our constitutional commitments and traditions and was the consensus form of discourse when the Constitution was written, and indeed that theistic frame of reference animated the religious freedom precedents that the Supreme Court identifies as instructive of the meaning of the First Amendment, why would we now exclude that viewpoint from operation in public policy? In the name of the Constitution, no less. The Supreme Court has conceded, after all, in the Abington School District case, the fact that the Founding Fathers believed devotedly that there was a God and that the unalienable rights of man were rooted in him is clearly evidenced in their writings. Justice Douglas's famous line from Zorak versus Clausen acknowledges that we are a religious people whose institutions presuppose a supreme being. Well, if our unalienable rights and our public institutions are historically acknowledged as derivative of the religious faith of our people, why the modern exclusion of that faith from the realm it is built? I'll go one further. How long will our rights and institutions outlast a public understanding and adoption of their justification? The late legal historian Harold Berman wrote that we must come to grips with the fact that the freedom of belief, which includes the freedom of disbelief, rests in the last analysis on the foundation of belief, not on the foundation of skepticism. This is what John Adams meant when he said that the Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people, it will be wholly inadequate to any other. Berman similarly observes Madison's conception of religious freedom can only be secure if it is undergirded by religious faith. Ironically enough, the court these days proposes that our religious freedom is secure only if our civil institutions are secular. But what precisely does that mean? Our word secular derives from the Latin word saeculum, which means of and pertaining to this world. It never meant unrelated to God or religion. The medieval view from which the term originated did not conceive that anything would fall into that category. It is a distinctly modern conception, then, that marginalizes religion so as to make secular and religious effectively mutually exclusive rather than mutually incorporating categories. In many Supreme Court cases, this is evidently what is in view. Yet what the court has not done is to carefully elaborate the analytical field of religious and secular. We're left with no definition of terms, no presentation of clear boundaries, no explanation for why the court reached the conclusion that religion excludes rather than includes the secular. Justice Jackson in the McCollum versus Board of Education case says regarding the category of secular that it is idle to pretend that the Constitution or any other legal source gives any guidance on how to divide the secular from the religious. It ultimately comes down to the prejudices of the justices, or using the word he offered, prepossessions. My take is that in recent decades, the secular category has been used by the court in approximately this way. Every statement, practice, imposition, purpose, and value is secular, so long as it doesn't invoke scripture or God or involve some action like prayer that points direction toward God. The secular category is thus made comprehensive. Religion is the occasional intruder. And so long as that theistic reference point is not in view, everything the government does is secular and gets a free pass. So, for instance, may the government, through compulsory education laws, take children for 12 solid formative years and subject them in government schools to a functionally atheistic and materialistic education, or subject them to what the Supreme Court calls the inculcation of fundamental values necessary to the maintenance of a democratic political system? Well, of course that's okay. That's secular catechizing. But may the legislature pass a law that calls for 1 minute of silence at the beginning of the school day, before the beginning of that inculcation of fundamental values from which God is born, so that the students, if they want to, can pray on their own. Well, no, that's an establishment of religion, as the court said in the Wallace versus Jaffrey case. So the state can spend years at taxpayer expense giving children a comprehensive view of the world, explaining its intricacies and operations, and foisting on them all the values ostensibly necessary for America to flourish, just so long as it doesn't suggest that God is relevant or necessary to any of it. In County of Allegheny versus ACLU, the court explained that the prohibition against governmental endorsement of religion precludes government from conveying or attempting to convey a message that religion or a particular religious belief is favored or preferred. But mind you, any other belief system, controversial as it may be, is entirely acceptable for the government to maintain and to dogmatically propound, and upon the basis of which to compel the forfeiture of your assets, imprison you, or drop bombs on your grandparents' country, just so long as the government doesn't imply that it thinks that the Ten Commandments are admirable. Let us do away with this idea that the exclusion of religious precept from government voice and mind constitutes neutrality. That standard is an illusion. Government policy cannot avoid value judgments. Substantive neutrality on matters of civil concern is impossible. The government necessarily must choose between competing visions of justice, of what is right, of what is the appropriate design of community, and so forth, as it designs legislation and curricula and imposes coercive penalties on citizens. Like it or not, there's going to be a prevailing orthodoxy. There is going to be a view of the good, which is derivative of a comprehensive view of some sort. Some framework of value must serve as the platform for the legal order of that the government administers. James Madison in Federalist 51 wrote, "What is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature?" To exclude theistic conceptions from those that may participate in the formation of government policy is simply prejudice and censorship. As a concluding observation, I'd like to propose that secular moral resources, to which the government under the Establishment Clause supposedly must limit itself when it's ordering society, those resources are wholly inadequate. Secularism has to selectively smuggle in components of the value structure from the theological worldview that it rejects and supplants. It survives on borrowed capital, we might say, use a timely metaphor. Because of that, it should not be surprising, then, to find that the prevailing secular discourse calls on us to assume certain stipulated values as Americans, and that we should avoid concerning ourselves with whether our predicate assumptions about reality are able to provide an adequate foundation for such values. But that evasion doesn't change the fact that modern non-theistic thinking is parasitic. Left to its own devices, it has nothing to offer. Yet this is the foundation for our government. In the realm of legal scholarship, the honest acknowledgement of this vulnerable condition of secularism is found perhaps most famously in the work of Professor Arthur Leff of the Yale Law School. In one relevant passage, he wrote that by dispensing with God, we did more than just free ourselves of some intellectual anachronism. We also dispense with the only intellectually respectable answer to the ultimate, why is it right to do X? Is it wrong for our airborne military personnel to drop flaming napalm on newborn babes? He wondered. Well, we might want to say, yes, it is. But the instruction from Professor Leff is that on a non-theistic conception of life, the question has no adequate answer. Why, after all, does it matter what one accidentally evolved conglomeration of molecules called a humanoid does to another one during its short existence in this vast, pointless, unplanned universe? Which brings us back nicely to Unger's question with which we started. What happens when the positive rules of the state lose all touch with a higher law and come to be seen as nothing more than the outcomes of a power struggle? Well, not good things, I would propose, but most relevant for our discussion this afternoon, it is not a result that the Establishment Clause compels us to discover. Whatever policy concerns we may have with various religious positions, let these be worked out in public debate and the political process. Yes, an ecclesiastical establishment is forbidden, but religious frames of reference for public policy and utterance are not forbidden. So let representative government give voice to the convictions of its constituents rather than being silenced by judicial censors. Paraphrasing Judge McConnell's statements from another context, there should be no epistemological pre-screening devices in our democracy. Thank you.
Let me thank Jeff also for his comments, which perhaps a surprising amount of which I will agree with, but I will have some pointed disagreements with some things that he said. But let me first say where I think that there is a fundamental agreement, and perhaps this will be surprising. And that is when we get to the question of what legislators may bring with them, or presidents, or city council members may bring to them when they are trying to make decisions about how they should vote on issues. They can bring a lot of things with them, and they can bring their religious beliefs with them, and their religious beliefs can help inform what their decisions are. And I don't know of any court case where it is ever said, or if it would even be justiciable, to say that a legislator cannot have religious points of view which he or she brings to bear on making decisions. That religion can't be banned any more than Wittgenstein could be banned, or Heidegger could be banned, or Karl Marx could be banned. We may not want to talk about it in this particular country. But you can bring these beliefs to make the decisions. And so that is not banned from the public square. And I don't know of any kind of case where someone would say a representative in Congress stood up and made the following statement where he quoted Jesus, and we should have that stricken from the record. That's not where the debate is in the United States. It's not whether people can bring religious values. The question is, what is the government ending up doing? So while a legislator may have religious values, can the government itself be endorsing religion, or endorsing a particular religious point of view, or saying, we like this particular religious belief? Now that's where certainly Jeff and I will have a disagreement, because I don't think the government should be doing that. I think the Establishment Clause prohibits it, and I think the Constitution doesn't allow it. And Jeff went back to some of the founding history, and I think that's an appropriate thing to do. I think we need to be careful about how we use the founding history. My favorite founding father, certainly for the Establishment Clause and for many other things, is James Madison, and Jeff referred to Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance. Well, let's take another look at Memorial and Remonstrance. Now, and keep in mind, of course, James Madison made references to religious issues in using the Memorial and Remonstrance. Just as I say, it is permissible to do, and a person can do that. But Madison, in writing the Memorial and Remonstrance, is making an argument that requiring a 3-cent tax, 3-pence tax, or as Justice Souter calls it, a threepence tax, is an establishment of religion, and it violates natural law. You can't say it violates the Constitution, because the Constitution had not yet been written. But Madison argued against that on principle, and I think Madison's arguments were quite right. And he argues, among other things, that the government has no power or authority to be raising threepence in taxes to support teachers of the Christian religion. That's an establishment of religion for Madison, and it's wrong. Again, we can't say unconstitutional, but I think it would apply to the Constitution. So let's take a look at some statements that Jeff didn't mention from the Memorial and Remonstrance. Madison: in matters of religion, no man's right is abridged by the institution of civil society, and religion is wholly exempt from its cognizance. Religion is wholly exempt from the cognizance of civil society, according to James Madison. It is also true that the majority may trespass on the rights of the minority when it goes into this particular area. Going on with Madison in paragraph 5, if you're interested. Because referring to the bill that was being proposed to have threepence tax for support teachers of the Christian religion, the bill implies, wrongly Madison would say, either that the civil magistrate is a competent judge of religious truth, or that he may employ religion as an engine of civil society. Employing religion as an engine of civil society was impermissible, according to James Madison, whose bona fides have been recommended by Jeff here today. Now, Jeff is right. James Madison also talks about religious reasons for this. But Madison expresses not only religious reasons for supporting his position, but he offers secular, and we could say constitutional, reasons for it as well. So you can make the religious arguments, but that doesn't mean you don't have an obligation also to attempt to make it into some other form as well. So religion should be exempt from the power of government. Well, now let's take a look forward 2 years. Madison is now in Philadelphia at the Constitutional Convention, and he is helping to write the Constitution of the United States. Question: where in the Constitution is the President or the Congress given any powers whatsoever over the matter of religion? Now, we know that Article 1, Section 8, we've taken constitutional law, that we have express powers. We do not have implied powers for Congress. So the list of what Congress can do and what Congress cannot do is written into Article 1, Section 8. And so I ask you, where in Article 1, Section 8 does it say the government may make general statements about religion? The government may erect monuments to support the Ten Commandments. The government may offer its opinions on religious truths. Where in Article 1, Section 8 does it say that? And the answer, of course, is nowhere does it say that. Now, Jeff made a reference to God being referenced in the Declaration of Independence. And if we can say it's important that God was identified in the Declaration of Independence for helping us to understand who we are, then I'd say, what happened? Did they forget who God was when it came to writing the Constitution in 1787? Because God is not mentioned in the Constitution of 1787 with one qualifier, which is the Constitution signed in the year of our Lord, 1787. So there's the pro forma saying reference to war, but the divine creator, which was mentioned in the Declaration of Independence, somehow is omitted from the Constitution. So the Constitution becomes a what? Secular document. No power given to Congress to make statements about religion or to offer religious truths or to offer religious interpretations or to support particular religious beliefs. Nothing, Article 1, Section 8. And nothing in where presidential powers are articulated either. Well, now let's go forward another couple of years. We come to the Bill of Rights. And so what do we say with the Bill of Rights? And Madison first believes that we do not need to have a Bill of Rights. And he thinks that one of the problems with the Bill of Rights is that as soon as you start identifying some rights, then you'll have to say, well, do you need to make it an exhaustive list or not? Well, Madison had another initial objection to a Bill of Rights. And here's what Madison's, one of his initial objections, now he overcame this and he had reasons for that. But Madison said, one of the problems with having a Bill of Rights is that it will be a paper guarantee and it won't have meaning. So, Jeff gave us some examples of things that were done shortly after the Constitution was done that would be supporting religion and promoting religion, saying somehow, well, they wrote the Constitution and then they did these things to promote religion, that must mean that's the way that we interpret the Constitution, being consistent with that. What did Madison say? He refers to the the Bill of Rights in these states, repeated violations of these parchment barriers, that is, Bill of Rights in the states, have been committed by overbearing majorities in every state. In Virginia, I have seen the Bill of Rights violated in every instance where it has been opposed to a popular current. Notwithstanding the explicit provision contained in the Instrument for the Rights of Conscience, it is well known that a religious establishment would have taken place in that state. So you say you can't do it, and what are politicians going to do? Politicians, surprisingly, like to use religion to advance political goals. Can you think of any president within the last 2 months who has used religious language in order to be able to promote goals? Can you think of any president in the last 8 years who did that? Can you think of any presidents in the last 16 years who have talked about religion in a way to support their political policies? Now, do we think that's a good idea or not for politicians to be able to use religion? Well, Madison thought politicians are going to manipulate religion. So if we have a politician that we don't like and they're using religion, it's not difficult at all for us to say that's cynical, that's pandering, that is using religion in order to be able to get support of the people. That's for politicians we don't like. For politicians we do like, well, they're promoting religion and that's a good thing. In other words, religion ends up being used by politicians to promote agendas. The party that doesn't like what the politician is saying, it's pandering, and the other side will say the opposite. So we have this back and forth. So is using religion a good way to be promoting your political values? Well, maybe yes, maybe not. By coincidence, this morning I received an article by a, I don't know whether to say colleague or friend or sparring partner of mine named Joe LeConte, who's quite conservative, a very strong supporter of the Bush administration, a supporter of the war in Iraq. He just published an article in the Weekly Standard, and he just wrote about Obama and religion. And do you think he's saying, I am glad that Obama is talking about religion, I am glad that Obama is using religion? He liked it when George Bush used religion, and he would talk about how those are part of our fundamental values of the country and should be able to do it. But lo and behold, Joe LeConte now has some problems with the people whom Barack Obama has chosen to support him on religion. And he says they, quote, have a political agenda, these advisors that Barack Obama is surrounding himself, a political agenda nearly indistinguishable from the Democratic Party platform, end quote. And I say to that, oh my God. They might be Democrats and religious people too. And if you are a good conservative Republican, you should be horrified that political leaders would have their viewpoints similar to the Democratic Party. But should we be horrified if the religious advisors, the Republican president, have the political views consistent with the Republican Party? Is that equally horrible, or do we just say, well, if it's a liberal doing it, it's not a good idea. If it's a conservative doing it, it's okay. Of course, that shouldn't be the standard. We all understand that. But just as Madison said at the War Memorial and Remonstrance, as soon as you start using religion to advance your political cause, you're going to end up causing dissension about that. And Madison predicted that in 1785, and Joe LeConte proved it today, this morning. That's going to be a problem, and we're always going to have that problem. Now, that doesn't mean people can't talk about religion. A member of Congress is safe to talk about religion. Does that mean it's a good idea? Well, perhaps it depends on where you're standing. Now, let's take a look at another thing. Jeff made reference to the Declaration of Independence, one of my favorite documents, a very interesting document. But let's say, how do we interpret the Declaration of Independence? Jeff made reference to the fact that there is reference to a divine creator. Well, there are other things that are said in the Declaration of Independence, including that all men are created equal. So how do we understand all men are created equal? The person who wrote that, Thomas Jefferson, owned slaves. We all know that. Many of the members of the Congress, the Continental Congress, own slaves. So what does that mean when we see God sanctions this experiment and we hold slaves? Does that mean that we should take the religious points of view of the people who wrote that document as somehow being our guide? Do we take them as a guide with it when it comes to the question of slavery? And I hope that the answer for every person in this room is absolutely not. We see very clearly an inconsistency between the principles enunciated in the Declaration of Independence and how they lived their lives. Now, we see that inconsistency. I assume everybody sees it absolutely clearly, and I think we probably all say we prefer the principle rather than how they actually lived their lives. I think I hope we all agree with that, and we'll ask for a show of hands. I'll be surprised if anybody doesn't think that. But that wasn't always the way people thought, and the greatest example of that is the Dred Scott decision. the Supreme Court case where it came up, where the question was, is it consistent with the Constitution? Is it consistent with the Bill of Rights? With the Declaration of Independence to outlaw slavery? And the question is, were blacks included in that statement, all men are created equal? Now, I think we don't have any problem saying that not only are all men created equal, but that all human beings are created equal, and they are equally entitled to these rights. And to exclude blacks was inconsistent with that. When the Dred Scott decision had to deal with that issue, Dred Scott decision made the decision the other, made, said it the other way. It was said that if you somehow said that the founders were inconsistent with their principles, you would be calling them hypocrites, and that we should interpret the Declaration of Independence consistent with the practices of the founders, consistent with what they said and did, rather than what those words might otherwise mean. So the Dred Scott decision, if the language as understood in that day, Jeff's been telling us we should be understanding the language as understood in that day, would embrace them, the conduct of the distinguished men who framed the Declaration of Independence would have been utterly and flagrantly inconsistent with the principles that they asserted. So the Dred Scott Court and Chief Justice Roger Taney had the decision. Do we take the practices which permitted slavery, or do we take the principle that all men are created equal? The Dred Scott decision, arguably the most notoriously bad decision in the United States Supreme Court, said we're going to go after the practices, we're going to look at what they did, we're not going to look at what the principle is that's underlying it. So let's now come back and let me try and end with a particular example to see, just see how this might flow. I'm from the state of Utah originally, that's where I was a few days ago. Utah is a state that's probably about 62% LDS, Mormon. So it's one of the two states in the country where there's a majority of one religious denomination. The state legislature is typically around 90% Mormon. So we have a state legislature, very religious. We have a state that's originally founded by religious people, make an analogy to the United States in that particular way. Okay, so what can the Utah legislature do with that, with regards to Mormonism? Can they erect a Mormon version of the Ten Commandments? So within the Book of Mormon, there's the Book of Mosiah, where the Ten Commandments is listed. Can the state of Utah put on the state capitol building a Ten Commandments monument and have the site Mosiah, which is in the Book of Mormon? There's something wrong with that. Could the Utah legislature say, Utah is a Mormon state, and then argue that it's okay for them to say that, put over all public buildings, Utah is a Mormon state? Now, you have a majority of these people who believe that. In a way, it's true because a majority of the population is Mormon. It was founded originally by the Mormons, so you can say Utah is a Mormon state. Now, suppose the legislature decides to do that. Is there anything wrong with that? Let's put aside the question of the Constitution for a minute. That's important. But let's ask the question, is there anything wrong with the Utah legislature endorsing Mormonism, using their political power as the majority in Utah? Now, I suspect if you're an evangelical Christian, or a Catholic, or an Orthodox, or a Muslim living in Utah, you would find there that being something wrong about the legislature doing that, and I suspect you wouldn't like it. I suspect even the legislature wouldn't like doing it, but this is a hypothetical case. What's wrong with doing that? You can say, well, they're using their religious principles, their religious beliefs, their religious values, the religious traditions. That's correct as a matter of demography. It's correct as a matter of history. Let's use religion and let's declare Utah a Mormon state. And let's put on driver's licenses, let's put on the state motto, Utah is a Mormon state. We could do all of that, but there's something wrong with it. And what's wrong with it? I think we can say, putting again aside the question of the Constitution, government shouldn't be in the business of trying to make these kinds of statements about what is religion, who a people should be, what is the orthodox religion, what is not an orthodox religion, what is a preferred religion. That's not really the business of government. The rules ought to be set up in such a way, let's call them secular rules. Secular, not because religion is bad, not for any reason because religion is bad or because religion should be put aside, but the rules ought to be fair for everybody. Just if we have football rules, we don't want rules that are preferring one team. We don't want us to say, well, if you're the home team or if you have a larger school, then you get to win on certain kinds of calls. We want the rules to be absolutely strict, absolutely neutral, absolutely secular, not to show preference, not to show balance, And that's not because we don't want to have an exciting and interesting and entertaining football game. We want that. But we want that to come on the field by people who are engaging in these activities by following the rules that don't favor one or another. Look to the U.S. Constitution. Where does it say government has authority to be making any statements regarding religion? We know that there's a prohibition on government establishing religion, prohibition on government interfering with free exercise of religion. We know those. It's taking religion out of the Constitution. It's not taking religion out of the citizens, not out of the hearts of the people, not out of the churches. That's not it. It's letting it flourish there. We also have in the Constitution, Article 6, Section 3, no religious test for public office. Jeff made the reference that many of the states in 1787 had religious tests for public office, and he is absolutely right with that. And almost every state in Europe had a religious test for public office. You had to belong to a certain religion or one of a few selected religions in order to be able to hold public office. Jeff uses that as an example. Well, religion is important. If that's the case, why did the founders strike that from the Constitution? And why did every state during the next 30 years, one after another, strike those provisions from the constitutions of the various states? Jeff was right in 1787. Jeff would be wrong in 1833 when the last state had removed that. Requiring religion for public office is prohibited by the Constitution, and it can be prohibited by every state. So religion is important. People should be able to talk about it. It's part of our lives. It's very important. The legislature can use it. But it's not the business of the government to be putting its thumb on the scale and saying, these are the preferred religions, whether it is the Mormon Church in Utah, or whether it is Catholicism in the state of Rhode Island, or whether it is Christianity generally in America, or whether it's Judeo-Christianity in America. The government stays out of that. The Constitution stays out of it. The government ought to stay out of it and let religion thrive with the people. That's what Madison wanted. I think Madison was right. That's why we're a religious country. We're a religious country in part because the Constitution originally provided no state involvement in religion. Thank you.
I'm not sure whether Jeremy was asking the question of whether Utah and Mormonism is the state religion on its license plate a bad policy decision, or the question at issue, is it a violation of the Establishment Clause? Well, of course it's not a violation of the Establishment Clause. As I said, the Establishment Clause was a federalism principle that explicitly stated by all those who were gathered at the time, we acknowledge that states have particular religious establishments. The federal or national government is not going to participate in that. Edward Corwin, eminent constitutional law scholar, wrote in 1949, in short, the principal importance of the amendment lay in the separation which it effected between the respective jurisdictions of state and nation regarding religion, rather than its bearing on the question of the separation of church and state. Jefferson repeatedly correlated the First Amendment and the Tenth Amendment. He said, certainly no power to prescribe any religious exercise or to assume authority in religious discipline, remember the institutional focus, has been delegated to the general government. It must then rest with the state. Justice Story, in his constitutional commentary, indicated the Establishment Clause left the whole power of the subject of religion exclusively to state governments to be acted upon according to their own sense of justice and state constitutions. Now, Jeremy referenced the fact that we had in 1833 our last state establishment. So for 40-some years, that was in existence. What we're seeing is this perception at the time of the founding that it is entirely proper to be acknowledging religious truths in the practice of governing. Now, the fact that the national government cannot establish an institutional arrangement is an entirely different question. Now, I think Jeremy gave us a fine example of the distorted and politically convenient use of religion. The main course is secular. Religion is that stuff that kind of intrudes every now and then. When you say the name of God, when you make reference to a particular church. He fails to see, I think, that a theistic view of life is like any other view of life. It is set in place. It organizes everything else that you look at. It's inevitable, thus, that the government is going to have some frame of reference that it appeals to for purposes of justice. He stood here, excuse me, with quite a bit of righteous indignation over the Dred Scott case. I wrote down that he said it was the most notoriously bad decision of the Supreme Court. Why? What do we mean by bad decisions? There was a moral problem with it? What resources does Jeremy appeal to condemn anything at all? It's a great question to ask. The government is in the business of establishing justice. It says, what is right, what is wrong? You are put to death, you are going to prison. You are going to elevate. Why? On the basis of some conception of life. It says, we acknowledge that there is a reality, we're attempting to conform to it now. Is the government not permitted to say that let me put it this way. Is it gratuitous for Jeremy to assign an elevated status to non-theistic conceptions of life and condemns all the religious views of life out of bounds? I prefer a little more of the view of the old days, where there is an acknowledgement of a transcendent source that tempers the extended jurisdictions of the state. So when Dr. Gunn says the government, as the government, may not acknowledge the transcendent or God, what he is saying is, for purposes of the government, human authority is the be-all and end-all. But yet then he wants to talk about rights of individuals. Now where would those come from? I've got plenty of reasons, along with James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, and a variety of other folks, likewise. And it's from the theistic framework that I approach these questions. What Jeremy would say is the government cannot have that approach. And that's what I'm suggesting is sheer prejudice. I'm getting indications from the back of the room that I need to stop talking, so I will do as much.